This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Robin Dow producing. Hope you had a great weekend. And if you'd like to chime in to start your week with us, 877-217-5757 is our number, and talk@talklouisiana.org is our email. Congratulations to the LSU women's basketball team going to the Final Four for the first time in 15 years. In her second year as coach, Kim Mulkey, who won three national titles at Baylor, has LSU two victories away from winning its first national title in basketball. We'll see what happens, but after a 54-42 win over Miami, the Tigers go to Dallas, two wins away from having a big parade in Baton Rouge. Speaking of LSU, Kevin Cope, the longtime faculty senate president, was slated to be with us after Dane Sherman, but he is unavailable today. His mother passed away in Florida. That's where he is, but he will be with us Wednesday. And as we know, Professor Cope is always a captivating and compelling guest. But so is the gentleman we're speaking with now, Dane Sherman, professor of note, full professor at Southeastern Louisiana University. He's been there for some time, and he was on our show a few weeks ago expressing his displeasure over some lack of what he thought to be and claims is adequate leadership on campus. And mind you, anybody whose name is mentioned or any leader of the university who wishes to respond to Professor Sherman has the opportunity. A full invitation is extended from yours truly to come on Talk Louisiana. But Professor Sherman, over the last few days, I think things have calmed down, unless you tell me otherwise, on the crisis regarding cybersecurity on campus and internet failures, but you're still not happy. Why not, Dane Sherman?
Well, Jim, thank you for having me on. And I want to make a note before I mention issues related to cybersecurity at Southeastern that Kim Mulkey and the governor of Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, and yours truly are all from Tangipahoa Parish. All roads, I think, lead to Tangipahoa Parish. So I want our listeners to know that, and we're certainly proud of the Lady Tigers. Not much has changed in about 2 weeks. And I'll grant that a lot of progress has been made on they won't say whether it's a hack, but everybody knows it's a hack. And I want to give an example. Internet on any wired computer is spotty. Moodle, which is the content management system, is up and down, but better, spotty. But what people don't understand is you've got 10,000 students here and not one student computer, to the best of my knowledge, that's wired in, which they're called thin clients. They're almost the equivalent of the old-time dumb terminal that we had when we were both starting out in college. Those don't work. So none of the computer labs, to the best of my knowledge, work anywhere on campus for 10,000 students. And guess how many printers are working for students on campus? One. One printer for 10,000 students. Now, students can go to the copy center. They've done a great job, but they charge now 4 cents a page. So there's one printer for 10,000 students. So the spin is that everything's back, but the reality is it's not back. And I'm still very frustrated, Jim, very frustrated about this. And I've tried to come up with some plans to solve some of these problems.
So it's not hunky-dory at SLU, to say the least, based on what you're experiencing.
It is not. It is not. And as a result of this frustration, on Friday I did what about 40 people asked me to do, and every time I told them I was overqualified, I applied for the president's job. And I sent it in on Friday. I sent them my 28-page vita. That's an academic resume, a cover letter, and a 15-point plan for day one. And I have more plans and more points than a fishhook factory. But I have a vision. And as I talked to my dear friend Scott Wilfong, some of your listeners will question how we're dear friends, but we are close friends. He says, well, heck, in Louisiana, we run for everything. We might as well run for president of Southeastern.
Is the job open?
The job is open. Our president announced his retirement. I guess it was in January, and the deadline to apply was Friday to the UL system, and I sent in my resume, 28 pages. And I look, Jim, I have no delusions or illusions that I'm going to get this job. So anybody out there thinks, oh, he's crazy. No, I know what's going on. I know I'm qualified or overqualified. I know we're in Louisiana. I know how things work, and they probably don't want an outspoken person as president. But they're going to have to deal with my 15-point plan for day one and my priorities, whoever becomes the president. And whoever becomes the president, and they're supposed to select May 1, I'm going to be 100% behind them. I've been here as a student or a staff member almost continuously since 1988 when I was a freshman. And so I have a 15-point plan for the first day that prioritizes four things: enrollment, funding, student mental health, and very important, campus free speech. And I think those are critical areas for this university. And I think that whoever takes this job is going to have to deal with some of the issues that I bring up in my 15-point plan.
Who will make the call on the selection?
There is a board. It's made up of board members of the UL system, and then they're non-voting members, community members. There's one faculty member on the board. And then I think the process, if I understand the process, they'll have two or three finalists that they'll interview, and they'll make I've been on provost committees, all kinds of hiring committees. I've been on probably 100 committees. And usually what works is they send in the names and the qualifications of the top two or three candidates, and then probably the whole board votes on it with President Jim Henderson's recommendation. So that's usually how the process works, and that's how I understand this work. They have a pretty transparent process laid out on the UL system website, as well as soliciting feedback and whatnot from the public.
So President Henderson, I would think, will have the ultimate call on this. And last time I checked, you're pretty good straights with him. You're
well. Maybe until this telephone call with you, I'm not so sure. No, I like Jim, and I like a lot of people that are in higher ed, and I trust them to do the right thing, and I understand this is Tyler Bridges and Jeremy Alford said, a long shot as our governor, a long shot, their book, which I have a copy of, first edition signed. It's a long shot, but let me just, I don't know if I made this completely clear to people. I've been on your show for almost 10 years. I'm a different kind of person. I am a high school dropout. I took my GED when I was 18 on the campus of Southeastern Louisiana University. Already had an adequate ACT. I took it on the campus, just very short distance from where my office is. I maybe 3 or 4 weeks later came to the university on an emergency loan. I later got a Pell Grant. I got many, many scholarships. I graduated from this university with a degree in communication. I was a campus leader. I was president of campus organizations. After I was on the debate team, I was really good in individual events like in extemporaneous and impromptu speaking, won a bunch of awards, and was on a scholarship for debate and communication. I later went to LSU, and I got what is called a terminal degree. I don't have a doctorate. I have a terminal master's degree, which is considered, it's not a doctorate, but it's terminal. It's considered the highest degree at what was at the time one of the top master's programs in the field in America at LSU. And then I've been in my career. I have another master's degree in English, and I am a full professor, even though I don't have a doctorate. Now, people say, well, how could you be president of a university without a doctorate? Well, I would say, well, Bobby Jindal was head of the UL system without even a terminal master's degree. I, unlike most people who become presidents in Louisiana lately, I actually have been everything from a student worker to a graduate assistant to a staff member, to an assistant director, to a department head, to a full professor. And I've worked my way up, and I've gotten there with help from lots and lots of people, but not because of my last name or political connection.
A listener notes that Sean O'Keefe, the former head of NASA, who is also head of LSU, did not have a doctorate. Of course, that did give him some problems, but O'Keefe, I think, was actually a capable man, and he got involved in Louisiana politics, as leaders at LSU often do, and as we're finding out, leaders on other campuses occasionally do, and now a guy who's a student and an authority on Louisiana politics, Dane Sherman, is throwing his hat in the ring for president of Southeastern Louisiana University. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we'll return with more from Professor Sherman after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Hope your week is starting well, and we're pleased to have Dane Sherman with us, as we always are. And this time around, he's speaking as a candidate, not for a public office in the electoral world, but a public office in the world of academia, where he has worked off and on since his days at SLU 35 years ago when he enrolled. Now he wants to be president of the joint. This would be an amazing American success story. He's also one of the fine writers in America about fiction and nonfiction. He's a capable guy, but I'm sure there are others who are applying who have high credentials. It is a good job. Hammond's a great place to live. And Dane Sherman, you, like no other person, I think, could extol the virtues of SLU. What are the other candidates looking like as far as those who applied by the deadline last Friday?
Jim, I have not seen any names. I suspect that will be released to the public. If it's a transparent search, all those names will be released, or at least the top names, the qualified people will be released, and I will probably read the paper and learn about it just like you will. One of the most important aspects of what I'm trying to accomplish is to address free speech at the campus. I believe most faculty are very fearful. The university has been under AAUP censure for over a decade, and that's just a bad stain on the reputation. One of the first things I will do of my 15 points is to start the CB for Godston Free Speech Forum.
I like that.
And I will fund this. I will fund this out of my own pocket. My vision is to have these like every other Friday. Auditorium. I've already committed that the first person that I will interview, it'll be an interview like we're doing in front of students and staff. Nobody's compelled to come. No fees, other than I'm paying the person a very small fee to come, because I'm not going to bankrupt myself to get my people I know to come speak, Republicans and Democrats and independents and non-political people. The first person that I want to interview is Scott Wilfong. And he is a controversial conservative person. He has a lot to tell these students about how to be a political consultant, how to, you know, be a student. He was a student activist at University of Illinois, conservative. And I would really like people like Scott Wilfong to come to this campus. Let's talk for an hour. Then anybody can come eat lunch with us at the cafeteria, which is a great place to eat on Fridays, by the way. And every other week, let's do this, and they can meet the speakers one-on-one. We'll have a big table. Anybody can come in there and pass through and talk and just have a focus on free speech on campus.
Well, I hope all the candidates' names will be released. Remember, there was a court fight over that many years ago, and Andrea Gallo, who at that time was editor of the Reveille, had to sue the university. And she, I still don't think, got all the names, but got the finalists, and King Alexander was chosen at that point. And we'll see. There may have been a surprise or two as far as applicants for that position. Who knows, King
now,
Alexander?
That was LSU.
I know.
Yeah, LSU, not Southeastern. I'm going to hope that the UL system will be a lot more transparent.
There you go.
And certainly I put my name forward, and I hope any of the other candidates will put their name forward too.
John in South Baton Rouge, you're on with Dane Sherman. Hello, John.
Dan, good morning. Jim, good morning.
Yes, sir. What's your question?
I want to tell you, Dan, I appreciate you stepping up. It's not a question, it's a comment. I, as a longtime resident in BR, I'm tired of people coming in from other states, making a name, and then leaving. Have you noticed that, Dan? People come
it's
in from all over,
Dane,
and
by
then
the
they're
way.
Gone.
It's Dane, but and I'm sure if he becomes president, you'll get to know his name a little better. But we do have a habit of people picking up and leaving, using Louisiana as a stepping stone. That's unfortunate. And then many times, as we know, sometimes they're told to leave. But Dane, I suspect you're in for the duration if you get the gig.
Well, I'll give my background related to that. I was born in Hammond. I have lived right around Hammond, except when I had to go off for work. I've gone to work various places, but I live in Ponchatoula. My wife has graduated with 2 degrees from Southeastern. I have a sister-in-law that was SGA president. I have also a niece that was SGA president. And my vision is I will only work for 5 years, Jim. I don't believe, unless you're extremely exceptional, I'll give you 2 examples, Norman Francis at Xavier and Dr. Savoy at Joe Savoy at UL. I just don't think a college president can be effective over about 5 or 6 years. And I will not go to another higher ed job. I'll go do my hobbies after this. That's it. One way or the other, I plan on this being my last higher ed job. And I will not be a carpetbagger bringing all the working here a while and then going up the ranks. This is my major contribution to education in my life, and it'll be right here.
Dan Downtown. Thank you, John, for calling. This is Dan with Dane. Good morning.
Morning. Yes, if selected as SLU president, would you support LSU as the flagship university?
I would. I would certainly. I understand that different institutions have different roles, and I think Southeastern is poised to be a great regional university, and I understand the concept of a flagship, and I think that it's important, and certainly I would. I do understand different roles of universities and different missions. And the mission of Southeastern is not exactly the same thing as the mission of LSU.
Thank you, Dan. Ray in Prairieville. Ray, you're on with Dane Sherman.
Thanks for taking my call, gentlemen. I'll be brief. I just would like to hear from Mr. Sherman of what a terminal degree is.
Okay, I can easily explain that. A terminal degree is a master's degree where they usually don't have PhDs as the common degree. And I'll give you 3 examples. My degree, I'm a librarian. I'm an academic librarian. And certainly Louisiana needs at least one president of university who was a librarian. I have a Master of Library and Information Science, and there is no PhD in Louisiana. There are very few PhDs in the country in that field. And it's considered the degree that you can get tenure with at a university without getting a doctorate. 2 other examples, Master of Fine Arts in Art and a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. Those other 2 degrees are considered terminal degrees. And if you look all across the country, those people holding these 3 degrees can be full professors. So that's exactly what it is.
If you'd like to get in under the wire, 877-217-5757. Iken Gonzalez asks your perception of Sally Clawson, who once led SLU. Were you an admirer or a detractor or somewhere in between?
Well, I'll say somewhere in between. I think she did a lot of great things for Southeastern. I think, unfortunately, at the end, she did this 2 checks deal. And she ended up, one of the few things I agree that Bobby Jindal did was firing Sally Clawson at the Board of Regents when she did this 2-check scandal. So though she did a lot of great things for Southeastern, at the end, to me, she just besmirched her whole legacy.
There seems to be aversion to public education everywhere. I saw where attacks in Livingston Parish for education failed over the weekend, and last Friday, amid a culture war in education, House Republicans passed legislation by Louisiana Congresswoman Julia Letlow that gives parents more oversight of what is taught in public schools. Is this necessary, Dane Sherman?
I don't think it's necessary. I think it's going to, it's not going to make Louisiana, in the case of Livingston Parish, and in America better by going the opposite direction we need to go in education. I think we need to have the best education in the world here in Louisiana and in America in general, and I don't think that the war against public education is going to put us where we need to be 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the road.
And I know you're a big advocate of libraries.
Absolutely. And at LSU, for example, the library has had visqueen over books. The basement was basically a frog pond. And I'm going to call it
what it is.
I know
you're
if
right.
There's some good old boys about like me. I'm not a duck hunter, okay. But darn it, you could just about frog and duck hunt in the basement.
All right. Well, good luck, Dane. Thanks for joining us. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We switch gears, turn the page, and we're joined by Philip Bump, one of the fine writers in America, works for the Washington Post, national columnist, and prior to that, he led politics coverage for the Atlantic Wire. As one of the paper's most read writers, he focuses on data behind polls and political rhetoric, and he writes a newsletter, How to Read This Chart. So he is one of the few journalists who knows numbers. And Philip, let's start there. By the way, it's an honor and pleasure to visit with you on the air for the first time. But most journalists, they have difficulty with numbers. And I've talked about this with my friend Victor Saxe, is that we have this conversation over the debt and the deficit, and many people do not appreciate that you can be lowering the deficit, as President Obama did, year after year after year, and the debt can continue to go up, up, and away, because unless you have a balanced budget overnight, you're going to always increase the debt. And why is it that journalists who can be so smart about so many other ways and absorb information and convey it in a way that is understandable have real difficulty when it comes to translating and transmitting numbers on occasion?
It's a great question. I wish I knew the answer. I mean, obviously, a lot of people in general are sort of stumble when it comes to math. My wife, for example, always talks about how she's bad at math, which, you know, makes us sort of an odd couple in that regard, I guess. But I don't know what the answer is. I mean, obviously, it's imperative for journalists to be able to understand these things so they can convey it to people. You know, I think part of it, honestly, is that journalists tend to use words, right? Journalists tend to be writers rather than people that do a lot of, math, science sort of background. So that may be part of it, but it's a fair question.
And my friend and college classmate, Alex Martin, who I worked with at the Reveille, he's now at the Wall Street Journal at high levels. He's commented that sports writers quite often, they not only write well, but they often know how to handle numbers better because that's what they do. Sports is all about who wins and who loses.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, my dad's a sports writer, as a matter of fact. So I think I probably got that overlap of journalism and numbers in him to some extent.
877-217-5757 for Philip Bump, and he is a prolific writer and a listener already aware of your work. And this goes back a few days. In fact, I saw a story you did just a few days ago on this. But what about Fox News right now? It seems that that's one of those stories that had a lot of traction for a few days, seems to be waning. But in the old days, it would have been considered unbelievable for anchors to authoritatively go on the air and say one thing when privately they believe just the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, the outline of what we understand from this lawsuit that's been filed by Dominion Voting Systems, which is alleging defamation by the network, by Fox News and Fox Business, is striking. Yeah, absolutely. That's an understatement. I mean, again, these are filings from Dominion, which I think is important to note. And, you know, these are assertions made in legal filings from Dominion. So, you know, perhaps there's some nuance that's missing. But I think that one of the things is that Fox is seeing catch up to them, the differentiation they always try to make between hard news people and opinion people, and how, you know, Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and so on and so forth, they're just opinion people and they just say opinions. And, you know, there is no, you know, there's this famous, in a prior legal fight, Fox News' lawyer said that no one should assume that Tucker Carlson is saying accurate things. because he's an opinion house, right? That was Fox News' own lawyer saying that. But I think one of the things we're really seeing is an erosion, the bleed over, the extent of the bleed over from the opinion side into the news side at Fox, which was very obvious to anyone who was watching that this line they drew was not the solid wall that they pretended it was. But really what we're also seeing is we're seeing the ramifications of that. The fact that, you know, just because you're an opinion host doesn't mean you can say things that you believe to be false without any sort of recrimination. You know, the bar is high here, but they seem to have dug themselves in a pretty deep hole.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org to reach Philip DeBump, who is a national columnist for the Washington Post. And Philip, are you based in Washington or New York?
I'm in New York.
Yeah, I thought so. Well, you're at the center of the universe in many ways, but what's going on with the DA there? Do you think former President Trump will be indicted? And what about all the maneuvering going on behind the scenes to either intimidate or influence the DA in some way?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I think that the story that we understand about these potential charges in Manhattan is interesting, right? And I think that there are a lot of people who are even skeptical of Donald Trump who are sort of raising an eyebrow. You know, this is something that they're sort of using this loophole in New York law to extend the statute of limitations, and then they're making these allegations about sort of taking what would normally be a misdemeanor crime and making it a felony based on the reason that this hush money was paid to Stormy Daniels, the adult film actress. There are all these sort of asterisks that apply to this case that make it seem like, I mean, look, you know, Alvin Bragg, district attorney of Manhattan, moving forward with this case, you know, it seems fairly clear he believes there was a crime that was committed and wants to prosecute it. But it is, of course, happening in this broader political context. And it seems like a case, I've written about this before, that it's sort of a bank shot at potential indictment, that you're sort of, you know, bouncing it off a couple of rails before you get to the pocket. Which I think complicates the politics and makes it easier for Donald Trump, for example, to say, hey, this is all a witch hunt. It makes it easier for his supporters to say that Bragg is overstepping his authority. And I think that this is the first thing that we're having in this conversation about, the first potential indictment, as opposed to something like Fulton County, Georgia, where, you know, there was the phone call with Donald Trump trying to influence the election results there, or, of course, January 6th related stuff, that this is the first thing I think helps Donald Trump set a predicate for look at the extent they're going to try and get an indictment. Mm-hmm.
But there have been other cases analogous to this, the John Edwards case, although that was a federal prosecution. And Bill Clinton was never put on trial, but he did lose his law license, and he was impeached for a sexual encounter. And this is what we're talking about. Now, Donald Trump, amazingly, despite paying $130,000 to try to keep Stormy Daniels quiet, says nothing happened, but she says it was the worst 90 seconds of her life. Michael Cohen, you wrote last week, at one point denied criminality and that he didn't. What happened to Mr. Cohen?
Yeah, so this is, that piece was really a response to, there's been a surge of people in the couple of weeks since the new attention has been paid to Bragg and you know, the role of Stormy Daniels here. People are going back to January, February of 2018 saying, aha, look, Stormy Daniels denied the affair. Aha, look, Cohen's lawyers denied there was any wrongdoing. And it's like, well, yeah, of course, that's what happened. Like, the reason Stormy Daniels denied the affair is because she was paid $130,000 to deny it, right? Like, this is not rocket science. So he had this window. Basically, the Wall Street Journal broke the story in January of 2018. Cohen went back and forth. I was sitting in the courtroom in New York City when he was, you know, fighting these charges and trying to keep investigators from seeing stuff they'd seized from his house and from his office. And eventually he folded. He pleaded guilty. He made sworn statements saying that this had happened, that he was involved in it. Stormy Daniels came out. She'd already given this interview to In Touch magazine back in 2011 about all about the affair, you know, well before any of this was important. And so we've seen that both of those actors have since retracted their stories and said, you know, Trump did what he's accused of doing. And so it's this really weak attempt at trying to defend Trump in the moment.
877-217-5757. Our time is limited with Philip Bump, but we'll take as many of you as we can, so please be concise. Phil in Jefferson Terrace, you're first up. Hi, Phil.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, good morning. I have to say, how is it that Fox News can keep a broadcast license? They've been lying to the public for over 30 years.
All right. Well, By the way, the FCC does not have authority over cable television and Fox. These presentations we're largely talking about, it's not over the on-air channel. It's on their cable channel, which is 3 million people a night watch Tucker Carlson. But is there any way the government, if it wanted to, could somehow come back at Fox?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, that's an extraordinarily slippery slope to try and have the government weigh in on what is and isn't. I mean, look, there's all sorts of garbage on television, right? You know, do we really want the United States government saying, you know, what is allowed on television? What is it? I mean, look, I work for a newspaper. I am very wary of having people file defamation suits against media institutions because that's a good way, you know, it's very expensive. Media institutions don't have a lot of money, and it's a good way to try and impact coverage by making these lawsuits. I think the Dominion filing is exceptional, but I think at the end of the day, the First Amendment is in place for a reason, and that is to keep the government out of the process of deciding what is and isn't information that people should hear.
877-217-5757, Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Patrick, please be brief. You're on with Philip Bump of the Washington Post.
Yeah, I think Dominion's going to lose this lawsuit because Fox News, I mean, Tucker Carlson went on the air and even said after that press conference that Giuliani and Sidney Powell had that there was no hard evidence. I mean, he went on his show and said that we're waiting for evidence. And Maria Bartiromo, who's also on Fox News, she invited Dominion to come. Well, okay. He invited Dominion to come on her show, and they refused to.
All right. What about that? It sounds like Patrick could work for Fox in its defense, but do they have a valid defense?
Valid is sort of the leading question. I mean, I do think it's important to note, and this is very, very important. You're right. Tucker Carlson was the first person to call out Sidney Powell publicly for making up nonsense about Dominion. There are two things about that. The first is that happened the week after Tucker Carlson had been spoon-fed false claims about Georgia, dead voters in Georgia from the Trump campaign, got burned for it. And so I think he was very, very interested in getting back to the Trump campaign to some extent there. But more importantly, even after Carlson did that, even after Powell's removed from the team, Hannity has her on the show later. Even after Fox News had said to its viewers, this is false, Hannity invites Powell on and is very sympathetic to her and her claims. So that alone is the sort of change, the transition the defamation is talking about in this lawsuit.
And it appears that Fox was ready to get off the Trump train, but then they realized that it wasn't good for business.
Yeah, this was the fascinating aspect of the post-2020 period and continuing to today, is that they understood. You know, there's this great quote in a book by Susan Glasser and Peter Baker from the New York Times, Glasser's with the New Yorker, in which they talk about how Roger Ailes considered Fox News and Trump, and he was worried because he knew that Trump had a stronger bond.
We'll be back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. A bit more time with Philip Bump, a national columnist for the Washington Post, and more than a few listeners have asked us, and Philip is an authority about all kinds of matters, but right now in Jerusalem, civil unrest has broken out in parts of Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has fired his defense minister for criticizing the government's judicial overhaul, prompting protesters to surge into the streets. Universities have to shut their doors down, and union leaders hint of a looming general strike. This is something that could have worldwide implications, Philip Bump.
It is, yeah. I mean, foreign policy is not my area of expertise, but I think that one of the things that we're seeing in Israel at this point in time is the tension that has emerged internationally, including in the United States, between more autocratic and more democratic forms of government. And I think that one of the things that is playing out in the streets of Israel today is a response to a push to the right, to a more autocratic form of government from everyday Israelis. And it'll be fascinating to watch what happens.
Again, 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Philip Bump, who's one of the best at what he does and writes for one of the great journalistic entities in the world, the Washington Post. He's based in New York City. David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Philip.
Yes, I would like to say to your guest before I ask a question, I'm glad to say the Republican House of Representatives and the Republican Senate in the state of North Dakota just passed a bill to accept the expanded Medicaid under Obamacare, and the governor will sign it. Now, in Georgia, Brian Kemp, the Republican governor, refuses to bring in the expanded Medicaid Obamacare, which mostly goes to low-income working people. He claims the state can't afford it, but he just or is about to start a tax cut for the wealthy. How can a Republican and many others like Brian Kemp be so insensitive to the needs of low-income working people?
All right. Well, there are 10 states that still have not taken Obamacare 13 years after its inception, the expanded Medicaid opportunity. And in poor states like Georgia, like Louisiana, it's a potential windfall. Louisiana saved billions of dollars by doing so. But, Philip, a lot of these Republican governors, they're going from a playbook, and some of them may actually believe they're doing the right thing. But as a state, it only costs Louisiana 10% of the expenditures involved, saves a lot of money on the back end. Why would Republican governors not do this other than because of politics?
Yeah, I mean, this is the, I don't know, other than politics, I mean, this is absolutely the argument at the outset when the decisions were first being made by states is, yeah, there's a cost that was incurred at the state level, which the federal government helps make up for much of that cost at the front end. You know, but a lot of this was politics at the outset, that this was Barack Obama and what was, you know, Affordable Care Act was called Obamacare. And this was a motivating factor in Republican politics for years until, you know, Donald Trump was elected president in 2017. They tried to overhaul the ACA. You know, I don't know. There is an answer. I mean, this is government spending obviously is important to Republican officials or has been traditionally. But this is also very much about politics.
Holly in the Garden District points to a story you did last week about TikTok, saying it's a generational fight. Why?
Really because, well, I just wrote a book about generations, so this is sort of in front of mind for me. But, you know, this is an app that is not really used by older Americans, but older Americans are the ones who are making the decisions about this. Now, this is a pattern we see in a lot of politics where younger people have one view and older people have another. But really so sharp is this that very, very few older Americans use TikTok, but they are the ones who are making the decisions about what it is and what it does. Obviously, that's not the entire picture, but it's a place where the generation gap is very, very obvious.
Philip Bump, who's one of the best in the business, and obviously people read what he writes, and that's the beauty of the World Wide Web today. And I like a story you did Friday. You note that groups who pay attention to political news are often those who benefit from politics. Surprise, surprise. But that might be something that is a bit of a stunner for some people, that that's who generally absorbs the news, and obviously if it affects business, the political business, it has more interest for those than perhaps for others.
Yeah, there's research done by Grinnell College that looked at who pays attention to political news. And what you see is that people who don't pay attention to political news tend to be independents, tend to not have college degrees, tend to be groups of people who are often, you know, tend to be lower income, tend to be shut out of the political conversation. Part of that, and you tend to be younger, things along those lines. So part of that is certainly that, you know, these people are less likely to vote and therefore less likely to vote in favor of their interests. But also just that we have a political conversation that's largely dominated by people who are well-educated and make more money. And then that can, you know, this overlaps with your previous question or two questions ago, right? You know, why are states not making decisions that would benefit poorer residents? Well, in part because the poorer residents have a lower voice in politics, and either relatedly or because of that, they pay less attention to political news.
And lastly, you did write a book that was out and about a few months ago, still available for consumption, and it deals with some of the topics we have discussed with you, the aftermath, the last days of the baby boom, and the future of power. Now, the baby boom is for those of us born between 1946 and 1964. And so the youngest people in the baby boom now this year will be 59 years old, and the oldest will be 77 years old. Those like Donald Trump and George Bush and Bill Clinton, all born in 1946. What does this mean with the baby boom losing a lot of its political mojo simply because of the fact that some are dying and some are retiring and some are just moving on?
Yeah, I mean, that's really, I think, and the book argues this is really one of the key underlying factors, a lot of the tension that we're seeing, that a lot of the factors that are that are common in the baby boom. That baby boomers tend to be more heavily white. They tend to be less likely to have college degrees than younger people. That there are a lot of ways in which who the baby boomers are is influencing politics in the moment. But really, the core thing here is that the baby boom has been the center of American attention and power basically since it started in 1946. And now, for the first time, it's really having to compete for power with younger people who are voting more, millennials and Gen Z, who have a different set of values, who look different in very literal ways oftentimes. And that's leading to some tension, especially right as we see baby boomers reaching retirement age and needing more investment in things like senior housing and medical care. Now they're facing new competition for resources with this younger generation. And I think that undergirds a lot of the tension that we see nationally.
The book is The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America. Philip Bump, it's been a pleasure. I hope we talk again soon. Thank you, sir.
No problem. Thanks, sir.
And we're joined now in our remaining moments by a local luminary from St. Lillian Academy, Alyssa McKenzie. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, tell us about St. Lillian's for those who might not be acquainted.
Okay. Thank you for this opportunity this morning. Love being here. So St. Lillian Academy, we are a school that educates students who have learning and communication challenges. We started in 2011 with parents and therapists hoping to provide a unique experience for these individual learners to have the opportunities to have wraparound services for support that would come from their intervention-based services and then combine those with the academic instruction on a school day on the same campus. So that's what we were founded out of, and we're excited to be where we are today and provide this unique opportunity for our community.
Well, this is Alyssa McKenzie, who heads St. Lillian Academy in March as we round the corner and head for home. This month is Developmental Disabilities Month, and that's something you specialize in, and many kids, as we know, have challenges in that area.
That's correct. And what we're working to is to, like I said, disabilities awareness, but awareness of the opportunities that are ahead for our kids and our students. So we're working hard every day to increase those opportunities and combine with other community entities doing the same. So we appreciate this.
Well, I'm sure many listening are aware, but some may not be, of St. Lillian Academy. For those who would like more information and about some of the events that you are involved with, what's the best way to contact you?
Well, we can look on our website. It's www.stlillian.org. That's no period there, but a Google search will get you there real quick. So it's St. Lillian Academy. You can check us out on our website. If you'd like to send an email, info@stlillian.org is checked every day by myself and our general manager, so we can always get information back out to you. And we do have a big fundraiser coming up this weekend. It's our annual fundraiser for raising funds and raising awareness. It's called Cheers for Children, and it's a ticketed event at one of our parents' home on Highland Road. It's a fantastic event.
Well, that's Saturday, April 1st.
That's correct.
And Cheers for Children. And, well, you want to give a phone number? That might be a good way to get people to respond.
Our school phone number is 225-771-8173, and we'd be happy to let you know more information about it.
How many kids are you tending to right now?
We have 62 kids in our on our campus this year. We are currently leasing from Broadmoor Baptist Church. And we're full to capacity there. We did announce in the last month that we are going to join resources and combine resources and join forces with Hope Academy. So we're excited about that, and we'll be able to serve many more kids. They have 67 students on their campus, and we are working through the logistics and the details of putting those two programs together.
Mm-hmm. And Alyssa has worked in a lot of places, at Children's Hospital in New Orleans. She worked at Neurotherapy Specialist and McMaine's Children's Development Center for 13 years. So you've been active in these kinds of things for a long time. And your staff, how substantial is it?
Well, we have a staff for the school of experienced teachers. Often our teachers that work with us have gone through the school system and either retired or moved into our program. And then we also have developmental therapists through therapy companies that work with us. So,
well, thanks for what you do. And thanks to First Financial Tax and Accounting Services for signature support for Talk Louisiana.